Okay, so good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I want to thank Rabbi Cashman and everybody else involved, Orly Rachamim, for arranging this. I don't see any faces, but I hope you are all with me, and I hope you can see the screen. So we're going to talk tonight about the Seder, and I'd like to begin by recognizing the challenge of the Seder. We have many mitzvot that we have to do as Jewish people, obviously, but most of the time, it's a matter of either getting to the right place or acquiring the right object, and then once you do that, you can do it, and you can fulfill your obligation. In regard to Seder night, though, it is a bit more challenging. I don't know if we always appreciate that challenge. It's pretty well known. It's a passage from the Haggadah. It's going to move you to the side over here. Where the Haggadah says as follows, "V'chol dor v'dor chayav adam l'rodat atzmo ki hulu hu yatzam mitzrayim," which means that in every generation, a person needs to see themselves as if they themselves have left Egypt. That is not simple. What does it mean? What exactly does this demand of us that we need to see it as if we ourselves left Egypt on the night of the Seder? Simple question the Maharal asks in source number 2, if you have it here, is, well, why? It's not true. We didn't just leave Egypt. It's just not factual. We are here in Toronto. We may feel some sort of servitude here, confined to our homes, unable to leave. I guess maybe this year we can identify with those Jews in Egypt a bit more easily. But we didn't leave Egypt. So what does that mean? And how can we do it? This is not something that happens so easily. The truth is, this really requires a lot of reflection. I think this is something that we all need to think deeply about. You know, there are some ideas that you can sort of share with one another kind of briefly. It's a certain halachic conclusion or a certain question, and you give the answer and you move on. I think this is the type of thing that you need to think about for a long time, and you need to let these ideas percolate in your mind and sort of reason with them. I'd like to begin, once we've highlighted this challenge, by sharing a few perspectives on what it means that we're obligated to view ourselves as if we have left Egypt. So we'll begin with a few ideas from the Maharal. Rabbi Yehuda Lowe, very well-known rabbi in Prague, 16th century, well-known for also for the famous Golem story, if you've heard of the Maharal. As I mentioned, he's troubled with this question, and he says as follows. I'll highlight it here on the screen. Aval ikar atam kfar amar lamala ki advarim shem chashuvim b'madrega, aki loy mitziutam enam noflim tachat hazman legamre. Says the Maharal, there are certain things which are so fundamental, so profound, so impactful, that they transcend the element of time. That leaving Egypt, and he mentions a few other ideas where the sages have this idea that we're supposed to view it as if we just experienced it. Leaving Egypt, getting the Torah, these things were so important to world history that they are sort of always happening. Their effects are always reverberating. And we always can feel that experience. That it is something so important that it is still happening. And that's one idea that I think is worth thinking about. Another idea also from the Maharal is a bit of a different perspective on this, and that is that we experience things both individually and nationally as a collective, as a Jewish nation. And what we mean when we say that on Seder night we should look at it as if we ourselves left Egypt is that God didn't just redeem one generation. He redeemed the nation of Israel, collectively, as a nation. And that, therefore, every generation is equally linked to the Exodus because we are all part of this nation of Israel. And the nation of Israel, collectively, throughout our history, was redeemed when we left Egypt. So then that's another idea to think about, what that means to us on Seder night, that we're all the trajectory of our history, our connection to our ancestors in the past and to our descendants in the future, how we're all one continuum, and we all experience the Exodus. But maybe the most And again, these things all require a lot of thought and reflection and contemplation. But maybe the most significant is the idea here that I have in source number 4 from Simcha Zissel Ziv, a well-known Rosh Yeshiva in 19th century. He was a big student of Yisrael Salanter, the father of the Musar movement. And he says that it simply means that we're supposed to use our imagination on the night of the Seder, that in order to get the appropriate experience for the night of the Seder, for the Haggadah, for the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, to have the impact it should have on us, the inspiration that we should derive from it, we need to use our imaginative faculties. And we need to do things to make things seem real, so that we don't just think about them, but we feel them. And so, it's true, we did not leave Egypt. We have not just left Egypt. Although we're saying, Chayav Adam L'Rod Atzmo K'Hilu V'Yatzam Mitzrayim, a person needs to see themselves as if they had just left Egypt. It's not that we don't realize that we haven't. It's true, we have not, but we need to pretend, we need to imagine that we have, so that we can get the appropriate experience, so that we can connect to the experience of Seder night. And what I'd like to do then in that vein is to think, to show, number one, how I believe our Seder experience, the way that it was set up by the sages and by the Torah and by the Gemara, is specifically designed so that we can have that experience, that we can feel it and not just talk about it or think about it, but to actually feel the Yetziat Mitzrayim experience. And how it's also specifically geared toward our senses, so that we can see, taste, and hear the Exodus experience. That is what I'd like to share a few thoughts with you in that regard tonight. So to begin with the Rambam here in source number 5, for those of you who see it, talks about has a bit of a change in the first source we quoted. It's a pretty well-known Rambam, as Rambams go. I'm always reluctant to say that any particular source is famous, because, you know, famous to who? Like, in what way is it famous? But as Rambams go, this is pretty famous, where the Rambam switches one word. He says, instead of saying, Chayav Adam L'Ot Et Atzmo, that a person needs to see themselves as if they have left Egypt, he says, Chayav Adam L'Har'ot Et Atzmo, that a person needs to show themselves. And I don't know that the Rambam is disagreeing with the idea of actually seeing ourselves as if we left, actually feeling like we experienced it, but what the Rambam might be suggesting is that in order to do that, we have to show it. And what the Chida or others suggest is that we have to actually, with our body movements, with our body language, with things that we do, show that we are actually experiencing leaving Egypt. And I think that means, you know, as we, many of us, for the first time, arrange our Seder, I think it means that working on the actual look and feel of the Seder, how our table looks, how the room looks, how we look, the clothes that we wear, it really means making it appear differently, making it appear as if it's actually happening. It means props, it means a background. If you look at source number 6, the Rav Yosef Karo, Shulchan Aruch, says here in the Laws of Passover, 472.2, says, Yisader Shulchano yafe bekelim na'im kefi kocho. A person on the night of the Seder should arrange their Seder table with the nicest utensils that they can. That there's something about Seder night which requires us to go a bit of the extra mile, to spend a bit more money, bring out your nicest silverware, nicest plates, and your nicest tablecloth. And the truth is that this is not something so simple. You know, there's a certain extravagance to it. There's a certain arrogance, potentially. We try generally to be modest in what we do. And so it's worth reflecting on why it is that the Shulchan Aruch, as part of our halacha, as part of our tradition on Seder night, is recommending that we expend, that we bring out the nicest things that we have. And so, in this vein, I'd like to share with you, apparently I'm losing internet connection, I hope it's staying, I'd like to share with you a thought of the Maharil. And I think it's just important to get a bit of a background who the Maharil was. Yeah, I have here in source number 7, so as you can see it, a biography. This is just for a response. So the Maharil is responsible for many of the Ashkenazic customs that we have today. And we're going to be hearing from him a lot tonight. Well-known rabbi in Germany. And he has this parish on the Haggadah. Many of the tunes that we use during davening on Yom Tov, the Nusach that we use, that we're all familiar with, are from the Maharil. So a very, very prominent player in setting Ashkenazic custom. And the Mishnah Berurah wrote, notes number 8, that the Maharil had the custom that if he had nice silverware from other people, silverware that he had taken as collateral from Gentiles, he would put that out on Seder night, even though it wasn't even his. And some commentators ask, well, is that appropriate? How can he use someone else's silverware that he simply has in his possession as a collateral to ensure a loan? How can he use that if you don't even have permission, generally, to use one's collateral? And what the Mishnah Berurah here notes is that it's not, he didn't use it, he just put it out. He just put out the nice silverware. He just displayed it. And that was worth doing because it creates the atmosphere that we try to create on Seder night so that we can have that experience. He also notes here, the Chavetz Chaim in source number 8, that generally we try not to be too lavish in the way we set our tables. Partially in cognizance of the fact that we have lost the temple, we have lost the Beit HaMikdash, and there's a certain sense of mourning that we generally feel. But on Seder night, we go that extra mile because it's worth it to create that. Similarly, relating to the idea of setting that background, setting the stage, the visual appearance of Seder night, Rabbi Yosef Karo, again, the Shulchan Aruch, notes that each child who's reached the age of education, meaning that they can actually understand why and what they're doing, should get their own cup. We have on Seder night, an obligation to drink 4 cups of wine or grape juice, if that's easier for you. And the Rabbi Yosef Karo notes that it's important that each child gets their own cup. But Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch, adds that it should be a child who can actually appreciate the mitzvah, actually appreciate the experience, can understand that what a mitzvah is and why they're drinking wine and what that might mean. But the Chok Yaakov here in source number 10, again, according to Maharil, argues that maybe not. Maybe any little child should have a cup. And even if it doesn't even mean giving them a cup of wine, but just giving them a special cup, so that they know that there's something special about tonight. There's something different. There's something unique. To give each kid a cup, even if they don't generally get one. And I think in this vein, there are many things that we could do. And I know in school, children often make their own pillowcase, or they make their own Haggadah. All of these things, the props, the things that we bring to the Seder table to make it look different, that's part and parcel of what Seder night's about, because it adds to that atmosphere, enabling us to get a bit closer to really feeling as if we left, to engage that imaginative faculty. And so that's one thing I think is important to think about on the night of the Seder. What can we do to make it different? How can we decorate our rooms? How can we decorate the table? What kind of things can we put out? What kind of things can we get to our kids to make them feel special and involved? But beyond that, beyond the atmosphere that we create, there's also, in terms of making our children see certain scenes, Seder night. And I quoted here to you, just as an example, an article here from Ari Yitzhak Shevet of Hamayan. And it's in Hebrew, but I found it very enlightening. In terms of the idea of stealing the Afikomen, I know it's maybe the most fun. There's an Uncle Moshe song about it. I actually find it a bit annoying. I don't know if you know the song. But there is a pretty widespread custom to hide the Afikomen or steal the Afikomen. And then there is usually a prize involved. So the truth is that this is number one, just one example of many things that we do. Many scenes that we create, many puzzling things that we do in front of our children to get them to ask questions. And the source for this is in source number 12, where the Gemara says here, Rabbi Lezer Omer, Chodfin Matzvot B'Leilei Tzachim B'Shvil Tinokot, Shlo Yishnu, that on the night of the Seder, we snatch the matzot. We grab matzot so that the kids don't sleep. Now that statement in and of itself is pretty cryptic. What exactly does it mean? We snatch matzot. Which matzot? From who? Snatching has a certain connotation of grabbing something quickly. And the truth is that the Mefarshim all have different takes on this. The Rishonim all have different ways of explaining why and what we're snatching. And they also each have a different emphasis in terms of how we should educate our children. You look at the number 13, the Rie Miluniel, an important Rishon from Provence. He provides two explanations here. He says, Yesha Faresh, Gadol le Gadol b'derech schok. So first he says, you know who's doing the grabbing? It's the adults from each other. Not the children taking the afikomen, but rather the adults at the Seder table taking each other's matzot just for fun, as a game. Ve'ikak sachibu mitzvah bavor tinoko. Showing, oh, I want the matzah. And you grab it from the other person because I want it. I'm so excited to eat matzah. And that's one explanation. So yishnu v'yishlu, right? Because that's exciting. It makes it happening. It makes the Seder a bit more animated. And some say, no, we grab him from the kids. And we play with them. And I think for the Rie Miluniel suggesting that one way of educating our kids is to be playful. You know, to do something out of the ordinary, to grab their attention, to sort of bring in the attention of fun, of playfulness to the Seder, to involve them. And that's one way of educating our children. Some children don't necessarily go for the long Dvar Torah they learned from school, or that gematria they memorized, or, you know, longer stories. Some kids need to be involved actively. And that's an important thing to mention. Sort of on the flip side of this, you have the Rashbam here in source number 14. And the Rashbam says that what it means we snatch the matzot, what it means is we take food away from the kids. Now that seems a bit cruel, taking food away from children. But what the Marashbam suggests is that we sort of acknowledge that what happens when children, especially at a young age, eat a lot, it often leads to them falling asleep. And we don't want the kids to fall asleep, and that, because it's important that they stay up on Seder night to ask questions, to get the Seder experience, so we take the food away from them. And I think the Marashbam sort of highlights an idea, which is something that sometimes we struggle with. It's always that balance, but there's a certain element of responsibility that we have as parents and educators to our children, that it's not all about fun and games. There's also, you know, some nights you have to be involved. It's important. This is something that we want you present for. You might need to make a bit of a modification in your schedule in order to prepare yourself to engage in the Seder. And it's about communicating that sense of responsibility to our children, who will one day have their own tzedarim and will one day be teaching the same responsibility to their children. And finally, I have here the Ritva in source number 15, Rabbi Yom Tov ben Avram Ashivali, student of the Ramban. And he notes that, you know, back more like number source number 13, but less about physical demonstrations, you know, physical playful games, and more about piquing their intellectual curiosity. And he says what the Ramban used to do is that at the very beginning of the Seder, he would tell his waiter, who was serving the meal, to take all the plates away because, hey, we're done. We've eaten enough already. And obviously that's not true. Here you have your children and it's 10 o'clock at night and they're used to dinner already and they're probably very hungry. And the Ramban would say, okay, guys, that was it. It's been a great meal, hasn't it? I hope you enjoy your parsley because that's the main tonight. And obviously, for the kid who is intellectually curious, that will certainly engage them to ask, wait, what's going on? We didn't even eat anything. And says the Ritva, that's what we mean when we say we snatch matzot in order to keep the children awake. What it means is that we tell them early, hey, the meal's over, you don't have to eat anymore, you've eaten so much. And that's enough food. Again, this is something that is a bit out of the box, something that we're doing which is a bit different than our normal modes of education. But on Seder night, we take that extra step to make sure the kids are indeed engaged. And I think it also, these three perspectives, again, one of playfulness, one of responsibility, and one of piquing their intellectual curiosity, are all different ways we should consider approaching our children. Some children need games, some children need fun. I know that some people will bring actual toys to the Seder for the Makot. They'll bring toy frogs and things like that. And that's one type of child really might connect to that. Some, you know, need to be sort of, you know, nicely and calmly encouraged to just sort of engage. And some kids might not need anything crazy, and they might not need anything too active, but what they need is you to really engage them intellectually, to pique their curiosity. And though those are the scenes of the Seder. But another way that we engage our children, ourselves, in Seder night is the element of taste. And something worth noting that I really thought about for the first time a few years ago, and it really hit me, is that there's something very unique about eating on the night of the Seder. Now, we know that there are many different holidays in which we're told to eat certain foods. Right, we have, you know, every holiday has its Jewish customary food. We have the latkes on Hanukkah, and we have sufganiyot on Hanukkah. I like to my daughter's over here. I like to joke with her that, oh, I'm so excited to eat sufganiyot this week, and she says no. Right, like we have our different foods that we eat for every holiday: apple and honey and Rosh Hashanah. But if you think about it a bit more deeply, the truth is that there's really only one day, I think, in the Jewish calendar where we're actually commanded, not just as a matter of custom, but as a matter of law, to eat a specific type of food. Any specific type of food. There are many days in which we're meant to have a festive meal. Every Yom Tov and Shabbat is like that. But there are very few where you have a specific type of food that you need to eat. And here on Leil HaSeder, there are many specific types of food that we eat. There's matzah, there's maror, there's haroset, karpas. Right? These are all very specific types of food, and they're all a mitzvah. They're obligatory, in a sense. And that's something to think about. And it's not just that, but you find, this here in source number 16 demonstrates this in one way, that it's not just about eating the food, it's about tasting it. About tasting the maror, tasting the matzah. Here in source number 16, this might not be the most popular thing to do. I definitely did not do this on when I was a kid. For most children, maybe the most difficult thing to eat are fruits and vegetables, and certainly maror. Right? I mean, no one wants to eat maror, but there's always, you know, as a kid, you have in the back of your mind, it's okay, just put a bunch of haroses on it. And then if you sort of, you know, dump a ton of haroses on the maror, then it's okay, then you can get it down. But the truth is, it's not really the most appropriate thing to do, because here in the Gemara, Rapapa tells us, "Al Rapapa lo nishi inish mara b'charosa dilma agav chali d'tavlin matalele marare v'inan tamara v'leka." A person should not marinate the maror in charoset for too long, lest through the spices they nullify the bitterness of the maror, and then they will not taste the maror, which is something that we require. Meaning you're supposed to not just eat the maror, but taste the bitterness. There are a few halachos like that, one of which is the whole question of whether or indeed we should actually combine matzah and maror. One question there is, well, if you combine them, will you taste them all enough? Will you have each individual taste? And on Seder night, one way of engaging children in learning is not just through telling, but it's through tasting. We learn through the taste. We try to experience what that bitterness is like. What does it feel like to be a slave? Well, it feels a certain way. And one way of getting to that feeling is to eat that mara and to experience that bitterness. Which also, something I'll leave you to think about, which also brings to note the idea of tasting the matzah. What should matzah taste like? If you think about it, it's a bit bland, matzah. There's not much of a taste. In fact, we're discouraged from mixing any additional ingredients into matzah. We're not supposed to use matzah with fruit juice or sugar or other things of that nature on Seder night. It's supposed to just be flour and water. And the Maharal actually argues, I don't have it here in front of you, but he argues that when we say that matzah is lechem oni, when we say that matzah is poor man's bread, it doesn't mean that it reminds us of slavery. It doesn't. Matzah is representative of freedom. Rather, says the Maharal, that lechem oni means that there's nothing extra. It just has the basics. As opposed to matzah ashira, rich man's matzah, which has extra ingredients. And in a certain sense, it's about the blandness. It's about getting back to what's the most important to us, not the extras. And someone once suggested to me that maybe the point of the bland taste is sort of you can do with matzah what you want. It represents different things to different people. Which makes it even more interesting to think about how the Rambam here in source number 17 tells us that we're meant to be left with a taste of, in the time of the temple, the Karban Pesach, and in our day, the taste of matzah in our mouths at the end of the night, that we shouldn't eat anything after the Afikoman, because that taste is supposed to linger. And it's worth reflecting about that notion of taste. And taste is something that we experience at the time, but it also is something that lingers in our palates, that stays with us, and that part of the experience of the Seder is supposed to be so engaging that it's something that our children will remember. And how can we make our Seder something memorable? Something that will stay with the children as they get older? How can we make that experience something different, that really stays in their minds? And finally, beyond the elements of sight and beyond the element of taste is certainly the element of song, the element of sound on the night of the Seder. And I know that, you know, one of the hardest things when you get married and go to, that's a bad way to start a sentence, but one thing that's challenging sometimes is you go to a different family Seder table and you're like sitting at the table, and then you get up to one of the songs, and then they sing a different tune. And it's like a shock. Like, whoa, like that's wrong. They got it wrong. It's not the tune. And there's something to, you know, our songs on Seder night. There's something very special about them. They stay with us. They seem like they're ours. It's our family's song. And the truth is that the element of singing is one not that's not just, you know, something that we do, but it's really part and parcel of Seder night. You know, one thing that we sing on Seder night is the Manish Shana, right? Every child, the first thing that they learn is the Manish Shana. And if you think about it, Manish Shana is a very strange thing to sing. Manish Shana are questions, pretty simple, forward, blunt questions. Why are we eating matzah? Why are we not eating chametz? Why are we leaning? Why are we dipping? It's kind of strange to sing it. You know, it's kind of a strange thing to sing. The truth is, though, that the Maharil, who we already noted a few times and we'll get to later, the Maharil, who is the originator of many Ashkenazic customs, tells us that we should sing Manish Tana here in Source 18 with a pleasant melody in order to praise the Master of all. B'nigun yafel shebeach la'adon hakol. And that's kind of interesting. Why is that? It's a certain praise when we sing our questions. And maybe part of that is that there are studies done about the educational effect and impact of singing. When we sing something, often when you want to memorize something, you'll sing it. That singing is another way of getting those wheels turning, of getting the kids involved. Because when they can sing it, they want to master it. It makes it dear to them. It makes it something that they're excited to engage with. And that might be why there's so much song on the night of the Seder. Again, and we try to do a few things differently to up the ante, to do things, extra things, in order to make it just a bit more engaging. Something that we don't just engage with intellectually, but feel in a real sensory way. Now, one of the things that we sing on the night of the Seder is Hallel. And the truth is, Hallel on Seder night is actually quite perplexing. There are a number of things about Hallel that really raise various questions. Right? We know that we say Hallel pretty frequently. In our prayer services, we say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. We say Hallel during davening on every Yom Tov. And there's a certain order of events. There's we make a bracha beforehand. We make a bracha afterward. We say the whole thing straight. We say it standing. But on Seder night, many of those ideas seem to fall by the wayside. Number one, we break up Hallel, which is very striking. If you think about it, we say the first part of Hallel at the very end of Magid, after we're done telling the story of the of Yitziat Mitzrayim, and then we wait, we make a big interruption, we eat matzah, we eat maror, we do korek, we eat a whole long meal, we bench, and then only afterward do we finish Hallel, which is quite surprising. Number two, we say it at night. We usually do not recite Hallel at night. And we also say it while we're actually sitting at the table, while Hallel is usually recited while standing. And all these things are very perplexing. Now, there's a whole long discussion, which I'm not going to really delve into now, as to whether or not one should recite a blessing. The blessing of Likro es Hallel or Likmor es Hallel on Hallel on Seder night. It's a fascinating discussion. But one opinion is that of Rav Haigon, quoted here in number 19, the sort in the Rashba, and I think it's very impactful. And he says as follows: Chin Hishiv Rav Haigon, Mitshuva Shadvarim Kmosh Am Rabbi Tzema, Sheim Avarchen Ala Belal Psalchem Ligmor. We don't recite a blessing, the blessing of Ligmor as a Hallel, which is what Sfardim say often when they say full Hallel. We don't recite that blessing on the night of the Seder. Ve'inanu Korin Oto B'Torah Korin El B'Torah Omrim Shira. We do not recite Hallel as a recitation, as people who are saying it, as readers, but rather as singers of praise, as Omrim Shira. And many have commented that Rav Haigon is sort of suggesting that when you say Hallel after Magid, you are not just reciting a part of prayer, but you are bursting into song. It is the natural outgrowth of the Magid experience. It's that we are so thankful to God that we have to sing. And to interrupt that with a blessing would be inappropriate. And that's part of what we're doing on Seder night, is we're singing because of that feeling. We are giving a voice to those feelings of gratitude for being a Jew, those feelings of connection, for the Jewish experience that we often don't get to give voice to. And the Maharil, once again, in source number 20, has a pretty profound point in regard to why it is that we do split Hallel. And what he argues is that there are actually two parts of Hallel. And that's why we, on Seder night specifically, we split them. The first part of Hallel relates to our past. And on the night of the Seder, when we talk about the past, we talk about our history, leaving Egypt, eventually getting the Torah, as mentioned, Dayenu. So the first part of Hallel is looking back at that. And that's what we thank God for after we tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of the Exodus. We burst into a song of thanksgiving and praise to God for that experience. And that's the first part of Hallel. But the second part of Hallel is actually not backward looking, but forward looking. The second part of Hallel is our songs which relate to the end of days, which relate to Mashiach, which relate to the war with Gog and Magog, which relate to Tchiyat Metin, the resurrection of the dead, that we look forward to. And that on the night of the Seder, we are filled with such loyalty and faith in God that we're confident that just as we were once redeemed from Egypt, so too we will be redeemed once again, which is part of the reason that we're indeed celebrating. Although we were once slaves in Egypt, and now we were freed from Egypt, but there were many generations in which we weren't really free. But on Seder night, we regained that confidence in Emunah in God, that the future we look forward to is imminent. And it's not just about the present, rather, not just about the past, not just about the future, but it's also about the present. Because if you look in source number 21, well, one of the things we say on the Hallel, the Leil Seder, is Hallel HaGadol, Hodu LaShem Kitov Kilam Chasto. There are 26 stanzas corresponding to the name of God, Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is, has a numerical value of 26. And the Gemara says that this paragraph of Tehillim is called Hallel HaGadol, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Yoshev Rumo She'olam Mechalek Mezunot L'chol B'riya. That at the end of Halal HaGadol, we say, Noten Lachem L'chol Basar Kili Olam Chasto. Hashem gives bread, gives sustenance to all flesh, for His kindness is eternal. And then one of the other things that we're mentioning on Seder night that we're thankful for is that God is constantly involved in our lives and our sustenance. He's constantly taking care of us now, which is something very profound to think about, given our current situation. To be able to say to ourselves that as difficult as things are, we have faith that there somehow, some way is a hand guiding history, directing the things that are happening in the world. And when you think about bridging this gap, you think about connecting to the past and to the future and to the present. So song, the elements of song, is a very powerful way to do that. It's a famous saying that a tune, a nigun, is the way to get you from where you are to where you want to be. When we sing, there's a certain modality, a certain mode of existence where we can connect to a place and time that we're not currently experiencing. And that's something that we also try to engage in on the night of the Seder through the art of song, and we try to engage our kids with. And on that note, I'll leave you by quickly and briefly discussing the songs at the end of the Seder. Now, maybe the most popular songs on Seder night are those at the very end. Echam Yodea, Who Knows One, and Chag Gadya, the song about that one kid. And if you think about those songs for a second, it's actually quite perplexing that they don't seem like religious songs at all. The truth is that they really seem like children's songs. I mean, there's a refrain that goes back and forth. It's fun. It's a whole chain reaction. Who knows 10, who knows 9. It's catchy. It's something that even a child could follow on a simple level. And again, I think part of the idea of making it a song, making it exciting, making something that everyone can participate in, is part and parcel of what the Seder is about. It's about involving everyone. It's about making our history into a song. And if you look here at source number 22, and this is from the Ephod Bad, Binyamin Rabinowitz, a rabbi from 19th century Poland, and he argues that Chag Gadya is about actually spiritual ruin and repair. And each of the stanzas either represents something that we did wrong, either the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf, or how we complained to God in the desert, or how we didn't make Aliyah, we didn't move to Israel quickly and speedily enough when we were given permission to go back to Israel in the times of Koresh, the times of the Second Temple. And then each time we have a recovery from that, there's a leader that brings the Jewish people to a certain tshuva movement, and we repent, and there's a spiritual repairing. And says Rabbi Rabinowitz, the purpose of the last song is ki achare yitachen ki achare kohat tacho yimas kolev rafu koyadayim asher achare kohart patkot sharvale mitzrayim akol tzikunim shtiknu avod lenehem b'mitzrayim. That after everything we went through, after all the falls and risings, all the things that we did wrong and all the things that we repaired, until we reached the highest level. Until we reached the point where we experienced revelation, where we experienced the splitting of the sea, where everybody was able to see God. And we had the giving of the Torah. And then very quickly, we messed everything up. There was a golden calf. So says Rabbi Yom Rabinowitz, well, maybe the same thing will happen. Again and again, because that's what's always happened. And maybe, we never can really be sure that there will be a final redemption, because who's to say that when Mashiach comes, we won't mess it all up again? And the point of Chag Gadya is that at the end, there's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'shach L'malach HaMaves, that at the end of times, God is going to bring that final repairing, that final redemption. And that is something that will be forever. Despite the Vihisha Amla Vasina Valanu, despite the constant cycle of ruin and repair, of exile and exodus, despite all of that, we're confident at the end of it all, we foresee that final redemption that will be permanent, that will be everlasting. And through the art of song, through the experience of song, we try to make that experience real, something that we can see and feel now. And so, sort of to, in conclusion, to review, what we've discussed tonight is that we have a tremendous challenge in front of us on the Leil Seder. We have the challenge of making the Seder, of making Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, something that we feel and experience with our senses. Not just something that we talk about, not just something that we even describe, not even something that we just think about, but something that we actually feel, because that is the goal. So that we can gain, so that the experience can't impact us. And what we noted was that the way our Seder is set up, it is uniquely geared toward accomplishing this goal for ourselves and for our children who are even a generation removed from the true Exodus. And that one way we do this is through the sense of sight, through the decorations and the background and environment of the Seder table, through the scenes that we perform for our children, through the playfulness, through the joy, through the games, through the stealing the afikomen, through the props, and also through the sense of taste, through the foods that we eat. It's a certain show and tell also to note. We have the Seder plate with the matzah and the maror, which is another way of using that as a springboard for conversation. What is the matzah and what does it represent? And why do we eat matzah? Not just telling it, but showing it. And we also have the sense of sound and the song of the Seder, which is meant to connect us to that national experience of our past, of our present, and of the future that we so anxiously await. May it be soon. May we be able to soon get together with our families the way we normally do, and out of this servitude, out of this, and have an exodus in our own day from our houses into the public square. And I'd like to thank you all for joining me, and I wish all of you a wonderful Pesach and a wonderful Seder experience for your entire families. Thank you very much. I don't know if anybody wants to ask any questions. I'll unmute everybody. Anyone? I would do that. Okay. You can message if you do. Otherwise, thanks very much for joining. Bye-bye. Hey, very welcome. All right, everybody. Have a great night. Thanks. Bye-bye. Absolutely.